Welcome to Steppin' Out of Babylon, produced by Sue Supriano. Babylon is everywhere. It's the isms and schisms not only within the system, but within ourselves. Let's unify, stand aligned, and step out of Babylon. Hi, everybody. My name's Sue Supriano, and I'm really excited today to have as my guest Charles Kernighan. Charles Kernighan is the executive director of the National Labor Committee for Worker and Human Rights. And I've heard you speak, Charles Kernighan, over the radio many times, and I really admire your work. That I know that you work on issues of sweatshops. I think I first heard you talking about Honduras. A whole movement, fortunately, has started, it seems to me, around your work. I'd like to just know a little bit about you and how you happened to get involved in this.
Well, first, it's good to be here. You're right about the movement, and I hope we have a chance to talk about it a little bit, but really it was a combination of two factors. One was the discovery of the Thai women locked in the El Monte sweatshop here in L.A. And the other was, of course, when we exposed that Kathy Lee Gifford was using child labor, and she wept all those crocodile tears on television. It was the combination of really those two instances which took this movement and really put it in the national agenda. And universities have told me that after the Kathy Lee story, media coverage sort of spiked and never really came down. And the Kathy Lee, she was a great ally, actually. She didn't have that much gray matter. And she kept this thing bouncing along for weeks and weeks and weeks. So we do now have a living, breathing, anti-sweatshop movement in the United States, a coalition of students and labor and religion and community people and activists. I would say we have the strongest anti-sweatshop movement in the world right here in the United States. I mean, it's unusual to be leading on a social movement issue like that. Mm-hmm. To go back to your question about the past, I went to Central America. I was invited to be part of a religious delegation during the Civil Wars. So this was like 1985, 1986. And they thought that if North Americans were there, it would be less likely that they'd kill the local union activists in El Salvador, Nicaragua, Honduras. And so I went on this trip. And, you know, you can read until you're blue in the face. And, of course, it's so important to read. But when you're face-to-face with the reality, it overwhelms you. So being in El Salvador, I was assigned to a union person who was under death threat. And the person started to tell me the story of the union, telephone workers union. And six members of that union had been assassinated because they had dared to sign a contract. And it was a government agency, telephone agency. So the military came after them. They, in cold blood, shot down six of the workers. Children of union leaders were imprisoned because the crime of their parents signing a contract. In fact, the kids were given electroshock treatment. They were put into big... it was a Mariano prison. They were put into big vats of urine and excrement and filthy water. They'd be pushed under to the point of drowning. They'd come out gasping for breath, and they were given electric shock treatments, and you could actually still see, like, the burn marks, like, on their forearms and all. So it wasn't down there that long, but I, of course, couldn't possibly forget it. It's such an intense experience that really I've been organizing ever since. So, yes, I was involved in these movements all along for many years. But having gone there just changed my life, and I've never really looked back, and I've just been organizing ever since. When the wars were, you know, settled for the peace accords, like, say, the 1990s, we decided to make our committee. Our committee was called, it's the National Labor Committee. It sounds big. It's three people at this point. We operate on a shoestring budget, I mean. But at that point, we were the first debate, Democratic debate, within the AFL-CIO. I mean, most people might not know this, but the AFL-CIO, prior to the new leadership of John Sweeney, the AFL-CIO International Affairs Department was 100% funded by the State Department or by USAID or, you know. So in other words, they were rubber stamped for the State Department. This is why the AFL-CIO supported aid to the Contras. This is why the AFL-CIO supported, you know, the invasion of Grenada, supported the overthrown Dominican Republic, supported the overthrown Guatemala. So the National Labor Committee was founded in 1980. It was after Archbishop Romero was assassinated in El Salvador and after the church nuns were raped and murdered and 5,000 trade union people were killed. Finally, some people within the trade union movement, within Act Two at the time, Clothing and Textile Workers Union, the Auto Workers Union, Bill Wimpensinger from the Machinists said enough is enough. We don't want to support those military thugs. We don't want to support the apartheid. We want to support the peace movement. We want to be with the trade union people. We want to be with the women's movements. We want to be with these religious people. So in 1980, the very first debate in the AFL-CIO broke out on this issue of a democratic international affairs policy and not a rubber stamp for the State Department.
1980, so that's a while ago.
So it's going back. So that's when the committee was founded, 1980. Well, anyway, make a long story short, so we operated as an ad hoc group within the AFL-CIO, fighting for rank-and-file democracy over the international affairs policy. So essentially, when the peace accords were signed, we had the opportunity to dissolve the committee. And we decided not to because we had so many great contacts all across the country. And we could use this committee to help with solidarity for workers in a developing world. So we then made the committee completely independent. So now we're an independent, nonprofit human rights organization. But we're one of the first groups that has focused on worker rights as a fundamental human right. And I could sit here now and I could say with deep conviction that this struggle over human rights and worker rights in the global economy is becoming the next great civil rights movement of our period, of our generation. So it started quite a while ago, but, you know, there's been quite a history here.
Well, and of course, when we talk about workers, I mean, it's after all, just about everybody's a worker. It's a lot of people, workers and humans. That kind of covers the same very universal ground, and it has certainly become everything. As we know, everything is connected, but it's even more connected as globalization sets in. I'm wondering, Charles Kernighan, how, as I'm hearing you tell this, first of all, when you told this horrible story about the kids and the vat of urine and shock treatment, and I'm thinking, ooh, and I'm reminded of how so much people don't want to hear unpleasant stories, and I find that a real barrier. I mean, it's both a help and a barrier. I'd like you to comment on that, a barrier to organizing. Because people are shutting down so much these days, if they haven't before.
Well, you know, I still do have a conviction that there is a sense of fairness and justice in the American people. You know, in many ways, the politics is wrong. The understanding is wrong. The focus on themselves is wrong. But if you scratch deep enough, there is a sense of fairness and justice in the American people. What's going on right now, I mean, I think you hit it right on the head. What's going on right now in the global economy is a struggle of the hearts and minds of the American people. Why? I mean, the United States is the largest market in the world. For example, we take in 42% of China's exports worldwide. I mean, we are a huge market. That gives the people in America, in the United States, a certain voice. Because we buy these products, we have a right to question under what conditions they're produced. You know, how old were the workers? Were they treated with respect? So the companies know this. So right now, there's this fight going on over branding the American people. So they don't think or don't ask questions. And Naomi Klein was really one of the first people to raise this as a journalist and activist. But, of course, I'm looking at a case now of toys like Mattel is a California-based company. Mattel spends $686 million a year in advertising. Well, you know, it's incredible when you stop to think of it. Just let me put this figure out. We purchase $25 billion of toys a year in the United States. Huge industry, $25 billion. The American people purchase 3.6 billion toys a year in the United States. 88 million sporting goods, 279 of those matchbox cars. Just think of it. $25 billion industry. 80% of those toys are made in China. There are 3 million toy workers in China in 2,800 factories in the south of China. 3 million. 80% of all the toys we purchase are for China. There's not one single person in the United States who's ever heard from a worker in China. Not one. We purchased $25 billion worth of toys. We have never once heard from a worker in China who makes these toys. And it's the same for other industries. So on the one hand...
Wait a minute. What do you mean heard from? You mean publicly or nobody's ever had contact? Or what? Well, say a little more what you mean.
There's no parent, say, that's gone out to buy toys for their children, I would say, in the United States, who has ever heard directly from a worker in China who makes these toys, who would say to them, I work 14 and a half to 18 hours a day. I'm forced to work 7 days a week from 7:30 in the morning until 10 o'clock at night or until 2 a.m. They'll never hear that they're at the factories 113 hours a week. They'll never hear that they're paid 13 cents an hour. They'll never hear that they're handling toxic chemicals with their bare hands, the lead-based paints, the solvents, the glues. They'll never hear that the women in the spray paint department are sick and nauseous and on the point of vomiting every second of the day for these, you know, 14 and a half hours or longer. They'll never hear that the women don't even know the names of the chemicals, let alone the health hazards. They'll never hear that the women are cheated about half of the legal minimum wage and overtime wage. They'll never hear that if the women become pregnant, they're fired. They'll never hear if the women try to organize, they'll be crushed and imprisoned. They never hear that the women are fined 1 hour's pay for every minute they come late to work. If they work too slowly, they're fined 2 hours' pay. In other words, the whole system, how these goods are produced, it's hidden from the American people. And so, like, in some ways, we're involved in this battle. And I think human rights work is really so simple. It's to tear apart the myths of the global economy. If we lay it out very clearly and personally and anecdotally to the American people, they'll get it and they'll get angry and they'll know what to do. So a long way of answering your question is, in some ways, the American people have been tricked. They've been tricked into being branded so that Mattel will spend $686 million a year on advertising, but on the other hand, they make sure we never hear from those workers or even think about them. So we think about the toy, we think about the swoosh, we think about Nike, we think about the athletes, we think about the good life, but we never stop to think, who are those workers and under what conditions do they work? They want to take the brand and tear it as far away as possible from the conditions under which it's produced, and our job is to take those conditions and bring it right smack right back into the brand. And so I'm pretty optimistic that great progress can be made. But it's true the companies have done every single thing possible to create this almost like schizophrenic condition where people never think about who made this shirt, who picked this banana, who made this coffee. I mean, it's strange that we live like that.
You know, it's a particularly easy, Charles Kernaghan, and I'd like to, again, remind people who may have just tuned in that my guest is Charles Kernaghan, the executive director of the National Labor Committee for Worker and Human Rights. It's based in New York, and we're going to give contact information later on. But the National Labor Committee for Worker and Human Rights, which you were just saying, Charles, only has three people, even though it has a big name. And you're doing big work. And I want to say that when you're talking about China, of course, this is horrible, horrible, horrible. And it's as far away as you can get, as different a culture as you can get, as the less contact than a lot of places. And it's incredible what you're saying. People really, really need to know about that. And I also know that when it comes to China in particular, oftentimes, so I want to hear some other examples, oftentimes it's, oh, well, that happens over there in China. Things like this never would go on in our country.
Mm-hmm. Well, unfortunately, in 1938, or by 1938, sweatshops have been wiped out in the United States. They're back again with a vengeance. And by some estimates of the U.S. Labor Department, you know, a sweatshop, the definition, of course, is violation of wage and hours. Forced overtime, lack of payment of overtime wages, not paying even the pitiful minimum wage.
Next to slavery, I'd say.
Yeah, exactly. And it's all, I mean, New York, I mean, easy estimate is that Los Angeles and New York, somewhere between 52% and 60% of all apparel operations are sweatshops violating wage and hour laws. So we have sweatshops all across the United States, but particularly like in the main cities. So they've come back in a vengeance because what's happened, if you look at a company like Walmart, the largest company in the United States now. Remember, General Motors used to be the largest company at $26 an hour wages and $20 in benefits. General Motors is now the largest employer in Mexico. But the largest employer in the United States is now Walmart at $8 an hour or $7 an hour with no benefits, viciously anti-union, one of the most ruthless companies that this world has ever seen. Walmart has several thousand contractors in China, factories. Walmart's the largest producer of goods in China. Those factories are hidden all across China. And if you say to Walmart, just give us the names and addresses of those factories that make the goods we purchase, Walmart tells you to take a walk. They say that's proprietary information. You have no right to it. So not only is it, 12, 13 time zones away, not only is it a 19-hour flight, not only is it a language and script which is completely different, not only are the factories spread across China, some of them have no names, there's no business directories. Walmart won't even give the American people the names and addresses of the factories that make the goods we purchase. So we're in a global economy where this is hidden from us. And the workers in those factories, for example, I went into a factory, and sometimes when I do this stuff, I pose as an academic. I'm nothing against academics, but many people feel the academics don't do anything, so you can actually get into the factories. So I pose as a professor, and I go into the factories. And I'm going through a factory in China, and all of a sudden my eyes start to sting and water. And I look up, and there are 16-year-old girls making kid sneakers, assembling kid sneakers, and they're putting on toxic glues with their bare hands. There were big vats next to them marked XXX with the tops taken out, tin vats. They'd put their little porcelain cups into the glue, bring it up to the desk, and they were standing there, and the only tool they had been given was a toothbrush, and was slapping on the glue with the toothbrush. No gloves, no special fans there. 16-year-old kids putting this on, toxic glues. At the end of the day...
This is for Mattel? I'm sorry.
No, this is kids' sneakers.
Which kids, kids.
Kids, U.S. kids' sneakers. And at the end of the day... all of the workers had to leave the factory single file to break their spirit. And these were very young people. And the factory was surrounded by a 15-foot-high cinder block wall, surrounded with barbed wire. This is what we see all over the world. And the workers, 80% of them, if you look at the global economy now, 80 to 85% of the workers who are making our Walkman, who are making our CDs, our sneakers, our T-shirts, our university caps, 80 to 85% of them are young women, 16 to 25 years of age. They're locked in these factories. They're stripped of their rights. We were in Bangladesh not long ago, and I'd say to the workers in Bangladesh, the young women, do you ever imagine the United States, like where the clothing goes or where these caps go? They have no idea. And I'd say to them, do you think the American people care for you or something? They can't even imagine it, that they're so trapped in these factories with no lifeline, no solidarity, no understanding that, frankly, but the interesting thing, I went into a very, very poor neighborhood in Dhaka on a Friday morning, which is a Muslim holiday, just by chance, walked back into this neighborhood over this rickety bamboo bridge that the workers put together over open sewage pits. And you get back into the neighborhood and people gather around, and of course through a translator. And I would say to them, I was saying, the clothing you make, it comes to the United States. Bangladesh sends 924 million garments a year to the U.S. I was saying, the clothing comes to the United States. Maybe if we could put pressure on our companies, the U.S. companies, big transnationals, maybe we could put enough pressure on them that they could pressure the local contractors here, the local factories, to help guarantee your rights so that your rights are respected, so that you're paid at least a subsistence level wage so you can climb out of misery and into poverty. And everybody gets it right away. It was amazing. In these most poor neighborhoods, the oldest women, it was like lights were going off. And they'd say, of course, yes, that's exactly what we want. But then they'd say, but sir, please don't take our jobs away. See, critically what you have now in the global economy, it is true, not like the right-wing economists put it, but it is true. When you're surrounded by 60% underemployment, unemployment, you'd rather be exploited than to have no job at all. It's better to be exploited than to have no job at all. But no worker anywhere in the world I've ever spoken to says they want more sweatshops. They tell you, look, we need these jobs. We'll work hard. We'll give our blood. We'll work 10 hours a day. We'll work 6 days a week. But we want to be treated as a human being. They cannot hit us. They're going to pay us our maternity benefits. They're not going to lock us in the factories for 20 hours a day. They're not going to scream at us. They're not going to pay us these starvation wages. We're human beings, and we want those rights. And if you're willing to work with them on those rights, immediately, you know, they bond with you. And in the global economy, it's so clear you can no longer organize at the site of production alone. If there's not pressure in the marketplace, you can't go anywhere. What does Walmart care? If a factory crushes the workers in Bangladesh, fires them, throws them out on the street, it means nothing because word never comes back here to the marketplace. Right now, inside this global economy, if workers to be empowered in the developing world, and if we're to be empowered, there has to be this pressure back and forth from the site of production to the marketplace. We're locked in this together, and we're locked in it together in another way. It's not only, like, morally, of course, the correct thing to do, not to let our companies run the world leading in this race to the bottom. This is what Walmart or Nike or Mattel does. They have a system, obviously, where there's no rules or regulations for human rights or worker rights. Well, that allows them to pit workers around the world against each other. This is the entire strategy. Who, you know, in this race to the bottom, if you want a job, they'll have workers in the United States pitted against desperately poor people in the developing world who will work for the least wages, the lowest benefits, the most miserable living and working conditions. So we have this spiral, this out-of-control spiral, and it drags everything down, everything. We lost 1.3 million manufacturing jobs last year at a rate of about 110,000 a month. I mean, in other words, it's no longer an abstraction. It's not only morally the right thing to do. If we want to save our own dignity, we're going to have to work for the dignity of other people as well, because we're in this system together.
Yeah, we sure are. And what happened to the AFL-CIO? And what happened? I know there was a campaign against Nike, and I thought some kind of agreement. And if you'd comment on that, Charles Kernighan.
Well, first about the companies like Nike. There's been some changes, some progress, because Nike was one of the most vicious and filthy companies. And Nike was one of the ones that always said, don't talk to us. You know, U.S. companies, they don't own factories. So they don't invest in brick and mortar. Walmart doesn't own a single factory, biggest retailer in the world. They contract the work out. Well, that allows them to say, in the past they got away with it, they said, don't bother us. No, I went out to the manufacturer, go talk to the manufacturer. And Nike was like that, terrible. Well, you know, we've been able to at least, really this is quite a sea change, because we've been able to now make the point, obviously, if it carries your name and your brand and you sell it, you're responsible, whether you own the factory or not. That's a big change because in the past, the company's got away with it. So after work on everybody's part, so much good work done out here by Global Exchange and by other groups, like pounding away at Nike, you know, going after them with the truth. Well, of course, they've had to change a little bit. Not a lot, a little bit. So, in fact, the students have taken on Nike, students across the country, United Students Against Sweatshops. And one of the things they said to Nike was an issue we've been working on for years, this issue of disclosure. We want the names and addresses of these factories. And Nike said to the students, we'll never give you the names and addresses of the factories that we use to make your goods. If you weren't so stupid, you'd realize we'd have to go out of business. You know, we couldn't do it. Well, today, on 200 campuses or 98 campuses, Nike must disclose the name and address of the factories that makes goods for those universities, or they can't sell to those universities. That's been won by the students. So we're seeing changes. But, I mean, they're slow. But we're seeing changes. Often we don't point out enough of the positive changes. But it's all come about. I mean, companies have no moral compass. I mean, it comes about through pressure. Squeaky wheel gets the grease. Companies only understand pressure. That's why corporate campaigns are so critical. Mm-hmm. You know, we don't boycott. And you know, because we're working with workers in a developing world, you won't meet workers who want to boycott their jobs. Mm-hmm. In fact, the first principle of any one of our campaigns is to tell the Walmart, to tell the Disney, you stay in that factory. You don't cut and run. You work with that contractor, and you make sure the rights of these workers are guaranteed and that they're paid fair wages and that they have the right to organize. Because what Nike would like to do, if you expose the violations in Nike factory, out comes the knife. Nike would love to stick that knife into these young women and twist it. Because if you boycott or they close the factory, then those workers, for speaking the truth, are thrown out on the street with nothing. And you see, the message to all of the workers in those countries then becomes, if you open your mouth, you're going into the gutter, and you're going to have nothing.
Could be killed.
And in fact, you know, in El Salvador and other places, when the women try to organize, the managers tell them, you know, get your miniskirt because you're going to become a prostitute because you're getting fired and you're going to be blacklisted. And this is going on all over the world. And again, come back to it, the American people, it's the largest market in the world. If we raise our voices, we can make a difference. If we don't, we have nowhere to go but down.
I just want to say also that, of course, the American people are, in general, doing worse and worse economically, too, and so they're going to look for the cheapest places to go. So that's kind of a bind.
Exactly. I mean, people have no choice. If you're making $20,000 a year and you have a family, you have to shop in a Walmart. You have no choice. But it's this downward spiral. Exactly. I mean, Walmart, now the largest retailer in the world, the largest employer in the United States. People, $8 now, very few benefits. You know, Walmart now is so big. Walmart sells at $219 billion a year. There are 189 countries in the United Nations. Walmart is larger than 161 of those countries. In other words, Walmart's revenues are larger than the gross domestic product of 161 countries. Walmart produces enormous amount of goods in Bangladesh. It pays the women 8 cents an hour to 17 cents an hour. Starvation wages. Their women are beaten. They're hit. They're sick. They're working 7 days a week. They're asking for a day off because their families are collapsing. They're never home with their kids, so they're sick and alone. Walmart is 54 and a half times bigger than Bangladesh. The revenues of the government of Bangladesh are $4 billion. Right. Walmart's revenue is $219 billion, like I said. Walmart is 54 and a half times bigger than Bangladesh, doesn't pay one single cent of taxes, doesn't pay one penny of taxes to that government, that has to service 130 million people on that $4 billion healthcare, education, infrastructure, roads, disaster relief. This is the global economy we live in. And if the government of Bangladesh implemented its laws tomorrow, Walmart would pull out and go to China or Honduras or someplace else. In other words, we're trapped in this race to the bottom, and we have to do something about it.
Well, Charles Kernighan, Executive Director of the National Labor Committee for Worker and Human Rights, it's time to give your contact information because people might want to know more information. The webpage is www.nlcnet.org. which stands for National Labor Committee, NLCNET.org. The phone number in New York is 212-242-3002. If you note that it's the National Labor Committee for Worker and Human Rights in New York, I'm sure you can get that through information, too, if you forget that. Closing words, Charles Kernighan.
Well, if people want to contact us, it would be terrific. We are running lots of corporate campaigns. In fact, Disney and Walmart have just pulled out of a factory in Bangladesh to torture and punish the women. We want to put them right back in, and we want them to respect those rights. Walmart and Mattel have just pulled out of a factory in China because the woman spoke up and described these conditions. So, I mean, literally, this is a day-to-day fight. This is a fist fight. This is a real fight that's going on day-to-day, and a lot of lives are at stake. So it's not an abstract thing. If people want to contact us, there's plenty that can be done.
Yeah. And really for people to understand that it's all connected, it's totally all connected. So it's to our interest to get involved in this. Okay. Why don't you give the webpage, Charles Kernighan.
Great.
National Labor Committee for Worker and Human Rights.
It's www.nlcnet.org. And a lot of this material is up there.
Okay. Well, thanks very, very much, Charles Kernighan. And my name's Sue Supriano. Thanks for listening.